May I please the court, this is Jean Pittman, will present argument for petition.
May I please the court, I represent Mr. Lynn Johnny Liska, who, believe the record will show, purchased or sold a home that they owned in Beanville in June of 1983 and moved on the track of land that had been given them by Ms. Rooster's mother into a travel trailer and a room that had been constructed in a garage or a barn. While they were living in this property, they went and made an application to the Beanville Bank for a loan to build a new home. That bank wasn't interested in making a permanent loan, so they then went to Brazos Bank and made an application there. That bank was interested in making a permanent loan for the construction of the improvement, but not in furnishing interim finances. So they referred them back to the First State Bank of Beanville for interim financing. Now, at that point, they went into the First State Bank of Beanville and made their application. And the record shows that the banker with whom they dealt said that they indicated that paperwork had been done, and therefore he asked them if everything was ready to go, and they proceeded with financing this property based upon promissory notes, which one or the other of them would sign each time they came in and asked for a draw for their contractor. Each one of these notes indicated that it was secured by a commitment from the Brazos Bank, and the money that was the proceeds of each of the notes was deposited in a checking account upon which both Mr. and Ms. Ruska had the power to draw checks, and from there it was disbursed to the contractor who was constructing the improvements. At about December, after the improvements were substantially completed, they started looking toward getting their permanent financing lined up with Brazos Bank, and Brazos Bank had a title check run and discovered that there'd been no mechanics and materialman's lien contract filed for record and informed them. This is the first time that I found in the record that there was any mention by name of a mechanics and materialman's lien contract. And the Beanville Bank then sent word for Mr. and Ms. Ruska to come in, and they instructed them to go and get an attorney and get a mechanics lien contract drawn, which was done there after it was substantially completed. Well, when this contract was drawn, it had been dated currently with the time it was drawn, so they told them, no, you'll have to go back, get that revised and dated back before the construction commenced. So they went back, had their attorneys redraft it, and it was dated, I believe it had a current date, but said as of August 2nd, which was before the construction commenced. So clearly, they did not have any construction land or mechanics and materialman's land that was executed before the construction commenced, as we say is required by Article 16, Section 50 of the Constitution. Matter of fact, in the pleading, in the case of in the trial court, the Beanville Bank did not contend that they had such a mechanics land. They rather stated that they had been deceived, and therefore there should be a judgment lien imposed upon this, what they admitted was the homestead of people, because of a deception that had been practiced upon them, and therefore the petitioners were to stop to assert Larry Bethancy Homestead against this claim judgment motion. Trial court granted such a judgment land that was affirmed in the Court of Appeals, which asserted as an additional ground for affirming that judgment that there appeared an admission in pleadings of the petitioners in the trial court that there was a confidential relationship that existed between the bank and the petitioner. The notes that they had signed serially as they made these draws were all combined into a single note in February of 1984. And even after that, in March, they were permitted to borrow some additional money, and a new note executed in March, which combined the debt for the additional money plus the combined note that had been signed in February, and the note was signed by the petitioner Johnny Rusta alone. This is the note upon which this petition was based and sued, and I've already stated the result. Now, we feel that both of the courts below erred in adjudicating a judgment lien against the homestead. We think that clearly Article 16, Section 50 states the only means by which a lien can be created against the homestead, and the uncontradicted evidence in this case shows that neither of those methods were followed in this case. The question of whether there could be an estoppel, we think...
Counsel, before you get to that, what was the jury issue submitted to the jury? What did the jury find? What was the theory of the case?
They found only estoppel. They found that there was misrepresentation made to the bank.
Misrepresentation by your clients to the bank?
That's correct. The misrepresentation issue was very general. It didn't ask about any specific thing, but that's what the jury issue that was found.
They found that they represented or concealed a material fact from First State Bank, and that they represented the First State Bank that a lien existed on their property in favor of the bank in order to induce the bank to advance monies for the building, is what Judge Evans sets out in his opinion. Is that substantially what the jury found?
That's substantially what the jury found, yes, sir.
And he cites that Bray versus Curtis case, the writ refused NRE case out of Corpus Christi, 1976, as authority for saying that under those kind of findings, you can impose an equitable lien on a homestead. Do you agree that Gray versus Curtis holds that, or do you think it's distinguishable?
I think it's distinguishable.
Would you comment on Gray versus Curtis?
Well, Gray versus Curtis is not a case in which there was people living in the homestead. Bray versus Curtis was a case in which there was an existing, if I recall, there was an existing instrument which was represented to the bank which was making the loan to be a valid lien upon the homestead. I do not think that there has been any inroad yet made upon Lincoln versus Bennett as to what can it constitute an estoppel to assert the homestead defense. Lincoln versus Bennett asserted three instances where you could be estopped, and one of those, of course, was the instance in which there had been a conveyance of the homestead, and the people were still living in it, claiming that it was a singular one. Another is one in which there has been an existing mechanics and material and blend contract that has been represented to someone who has been loaning money based upon that mechanics and material and blend contract that it is or that it is an existing lien. The other is the instance where people displaying that a place is their homestead, and they either are not living in it, or their occupancy of it is of such an equivocal nature, where they are, for instance, living part of the time in one place and part of another, that you cannot determine which of those places is really their homestead. That is an instance where the determination of what is the homestead depends upon what the intention of the parties is. In the case that we have here, there was no equivocation at all in the occupancy of the property. We submit that under Lincoln v. Bennett and under the unbroken line of cases after that you cannot rely on a statement that's made that it's not homestead if there's unequivocal occupation of that homestead. And we also submit that you cannot be stopped by stating that I have created a land on my homestead without there ever having been any document exhibited that is supposed to have created that land on the homestead.
Mr. Pittman, I realize you did not try this case. There was no issue submitted to the jury asking whether or not this was the homestead of Rooster. Now, you are asserting in your petition, application for repair, that homestead was proven as a matter of law. Would you run us just briefly over the facts, uncontroverted facts, which have established homestead as a matter of law?
Judge, may I start by stating that it was pleaded to be their homestead in the pleading of the respondent. And secondly, the uncontradicted evidence was that they had sold the only other home that they had, that they had moved on to this property, and that this was the only place that they were living, and that it was family consisting of a man, wife, and child that were living there on the property some time before this arrangement was entered into.
Now, this was a 5-acre tract, I understand. Was that within any incorporated city limits, or was it out in the country?
South of the country.
You see any problem there at all in tying down where they were living as to where the house was built? Would it have any problem as a matter of law finding homestead?
Judge, I don't think we do in view of the fact of the pleading admitting that the pleading on the part of the respondent.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you
admitted.
You claim that a judicial admission?
Yeah.
I misunderstood you. I thought the Rooster's pleading. You're talking about the bank.
I'm talking about the bank's pleading, you know.
All right.
Stated that it was their homestead.
Would you please discuss the case that Judge Evans cites? He says the homestead laws were never intended to be the haven of wrongfully obtained money. He cites Balcom versus Texam Oil Corporation, 1967 El Paso NRE case, and then he later on cites United Savings Bank versus Frazier, that where the husband and wife have by their conduct led an innocent party to believe that a valid land has been create on their homestead, and that party is induced to invest its funds on the faith and credit of such land, and the husband and wife are estopped as to that party to plead that the land is invalid. Given credence to Judge Evans' writing, I want to see how you respond to that, to where he is wrong in citing those authorities.
Judge, the latter case that you cited was one in which there had been an existing instrument that purported to create a land upon the homestead, and that existing instrument was then represented to be a valid land on the homestead to a new lender who was loaning money to take up that land. Now the other case...
That's like Lincoln versus Bennett then. The misrepresentation was to a third party.
It's to a third party, to a new lender.
Yeah. And you think that's different from misrepresentation to the lender?
I think I think that it's different where there is an existing instrument that they're looking at. And they say, look, this is a valid lien on my homestead. And they are in effect trying to sell that lien to a new lender and saying that it's valid. That is a very well recognized exception. Now, the case of there not being a haven for fraud, that is true. I would call the court's attention, though, that, that the Dallas court has fairly recently, in a case in 701, it's cited in the brief here, following a commission of appeals case that held that where there is an existing homestead, that they will not impose, say, a constructive trust on the homestead because someone has stolen money and improved it, which is basically a, you know, the epitome of fraud, it seems to me. And in that case, they not only held that that they would not impose the constructive trust, but they set aside a default judgment that had been entered, holding that the court which had held that had no jurisdiction because of the homestead. It didn't have jurisdiction over the subject matter.
Did we NRE that case?
You NRE that case, yes.
Ms. Pittman, was constructive trust ever pleaded in this case, ever argued at any time up to now?
No, sir. There was confidential relationship brought up before the court of appeal that did not appear at the trial court level.
As in all those cases holding that money obtained or subterfuge dishonestly, you can follow that money and defeat a homestead claim, having all those been constructive trust cases?
Yes, sir. And the distinction that they made there is that if you take money that's stolen and you invest it in a homestead, then you get the constructive trust before the homestead is passed. But if you steal money and you take it and spend it on a pre-existing homestead, that then you cannot enforce the constructive trust against that homestead. But the pre-existence of the homestead is the distinction that they're making.
Do you see any conflict in the judgment, the trial judgment that was entered in this case, and any recovery on the theory of constructive trust?
I think that must have been what they had in mind, really, when they said they were imposing a judgment lien upon the property. Because otherwise, they're really, you know, with no basis for a lien except in the theory of a problem. And even though they didn't call that constructive trust, I think that that's basically the theory that the trial court must have followed in imposing the judgment.
Well, is there a necessity on a constructive trust case that constructive trust be pleaded?
I think so, Your Honor.
No trial amendment was sought.
So there was no trial.
So there is no pleadings anywhere in the record on constructive trust?
No, so there are no pleadings on that. That would raise, basically, as by calling it a confidential relationship at the stage of the appellate court.
You didn't comment on the Balcom case. I probably diverted you by mentioning United Savings, but will you comment on Balcom versus Texan Oil Corporation?
Judge, I'm trying to remember what that case involved.
Well, he cites it. He cites it for this proposition that the homestead laws were never intended to be the haven of wrongfully obtained money. Balcom versus Texan Oil, writ reviewed NRE 1967 out of El Paso. Does that help jog your memory any?
Judge, I think that's what the constructive trust was. And I think it was a case in which they actually, I believe that one of the ones that was distinguished in this case out of Dallas and that actually it was not a lien that was imposed upon the homestead there, but a lien that was imposed upon money that was proceeds from the homestead. A constructive trust that was imposed upon money proceeds. If I remember the case correctly, if I identify it correctly with the fact.
Okay, thank you. I guess just on the broad picture, what I'm trying to get in my mind is, do you have the money? You got the money from the bank. No question that you owe the money, I take it. I just want to know how to deal with that. Is this a technical kind of defense you're putting up, or is it, you can get the money back, but you can't get a lien on my home, which may very well be what the court should say. I think we all have great respect for the homestead law, and we know how tightly the courts want to protect the homestead. I'm having Judge Evans apparently had some trouble with trying to square that desire with the equity to the bank and being out their money for improving your home. Can you kind of give me some way to rationalize the justness of that?
Judge, I cannot rationalize the justness of it. It is, as you have stated, it is a technical thing. It is a protection that is afforded to the homestead by the Constitution. And we are not arguing to reverse the judgment for the money that has been taken against the petition. The only thing that we are arguing here is that there was wrongly imposed this judgment lien against the homestead.
Does the record show whether or not the petitioners are judgment proof, or whether or not they're making payments, or they have a capacity to pay, or anything like that?
It does not show whether they're judgment proof. It does show that they had not made any payments on the loan.
And payments not being made?
No.
So they get a windfall of over $100,000.
Judge,
is that the size of it?
They have a judgment against them.
Well, a judgment, something even worth paying your prison on if it's not collectible.
Well, that's correct, John.
So in essence, they got a $100,000 windfall.
This is not, though. There's nothing in the record show that they're not responsible financially.
Can the bank file its judgment lien and, by virtue of that lien, get their money when the homestead is sold or transferred?
Judge, I don't think they can when it's sold or transferred. They can if it's abandoned. I don't think that if it remains a homestead up until the time it's sold.
What I mean is
once it ceases to be a homestead, yes, sir. It can be.
But the proceeds are protected. In other words, if they sell a house and get their money, they can reinvest it in a new homestead, and the creditor can't get to it. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Jim. For a period of 6 months. I think the court understands correctly that we are simply arguing against the validity of the lien upon the homestead property. And our clients are liable for the, or at least Mr. Ruska is liable for the amount that was borrowed. And of course, it's a community obligation. Our second point that we have, I'm about out of time. I don't know how long this light's been on, but...
Just went on, you got 5 minutes.
All right, our second point is that since the note was signed by Mr. Ruska only, the judgment should be, provided that nothing out of the separate property of Mrs. Ruska was liable on that note, even though all of the community was. And this, of course, is a matter of concern to her, because this was a gift of property, one half to Mr. Ruska and one half to her. And whether or not her half of the property would be liable for the debt on that note is a concern. Our other point is the one concerning the action on the note by the Brazos Bank. And it relates solely to the attorney's fees that were awarded that bank. The bank had sued to recover on about a $2,500 balance from the note, which was unsecured, and had been sued in turn by our clients to remove the cloud on a title, which was cast by this late-executed mechanic lien, which had been expressly assigned to Brazos Bank, not to the bank that had furnished the money, but the contractor assigned it to the Brazos Bank. And there had been a suit by our clients. Well, they asked for damages, but they also asked to remove that as a cloud on their title property. And in the process of defending against that, well, actually, there was no real reason to defend against it because Brazos Bank disclaimed, said that they had no interest in that contract.
What point in time did this thing file?
It was filed as part of their original plea. And then they came in and in proving up this $2,500 balance on this note, which had not been denied under oath, they ran some $12,000 in attorney's fees. We submit that defending, if they had to defend against this cause of action asserted against them, was entirely different from the elements of their cause of action on the note. Therefore, under the cases, they should have segregated the attorney's fees incurred in prosecuting that note from the attorney's fees that were incurred in defending against the upcoming action. And that not having done so, they are not entitled to the recovery of the attorney's fees. Now, I guess rather summarily going over this, if there are any questions, if I could give anything.
Thank you, Mr. Pittman.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Ms. Pollard.
May it please the court, Mr. James Chapman will present argument for the response.
Chapman.
May it please the court. The 6 points of error upon which the court has granted the writ. Basically, the Dingle Bank's position regarding those 6 points is that what the parties were trying to accomplish here is permitted under the Constitution. Lincoln versus Bennett does not apply to this situation, and I'd like to discuss that case with the court in just a moment. Basically, what the parties were trying to do was simply acquire a valid M&M lien for improvements on homestead property. This is the kind of transaction that is frequently done in the state of Texas. Many people acquire their residences by virtue of granting an M&M lien, borrowing money, building a house, and living in it, and making payments. There was nothing inherently illegal, fraudulent, improper, or inequitable about the transaction that the parties in this case were trying to accomplish. They were simply trying to build a home on what was acknowledged to be homestead property. I know that Justice Wallace's inquiries about the issue of whether or not the property was homestead. I wish I could come up with some kind of argument or some representation that indicated that was at issue, but the fact of the matter was the parties knew it was homestead. That was never an issue in the case. It was clearly homestead property. The property was given to the Ruskas by Mrs. Ruska's family. It apparently has been in the family for some time. It will stay in the family even longer. There's very little likelihood that it would ever be sold. If it were so, there's no way that Dingle Bank could obtain any proceeds. The reason why this transaction went awry was because of the misrepresentations of the Ruskas in obtaining the funds that they were loaned. Jury issues were submitted. The proper findings came back to support an estoppel. Those jury issues are correctly summarized in the Court of Appeals opinion. I refer the court to that opinion. The bank's position in this case is based on a concept that I think is very well stated in two cases that are cited in my brief. I beg the court's indulgence while I go over those. In the Ackerson case and the ratification, which are quoted on page 6 of our brief, says that while it is true that a lien can only be created against the homestead by strict compliance, and here they quote Article 5460, and that a lien cannot be created against the homestead by an estoppel. And this is the Texas Court of Civil Appeals in 1935, and a case called Ackerson versus Farm and Home Savings and Loan Association, and the writ application was refused. That whether the lien is valid or invalid, the husband and wife can't stop themselves from asserting its invalidity by their own wrongful conduct. Then in 1942, in the Rabbi versus Federal Land Bank of Houston case, another case in which the error was refused, the court stated, that the Court of Civil Appeals stated, that an attempted lien upon the homestead which is forbidden by law is void and can never be made valid. Where such a pretended lien is enforced upon an estoppel, the attempted lien is not thereby made valid, but the recovery is permitted because the one pleading such invalidity is estopped by his conduct to assert the truth, the effect of which is to defraud and damage another. And that's precisely the case we have here. In this transaction, in the normal course of business in Burleson County, which is a small rural county about 80 miles east of here, it was common, because the small banks in that community don't normally retain attorneys or have them on retainer, they have access to them obviously, but it was common to offer individuals who were coming to borrow money the option of either having their own attorney prepare the paperwork, which was the shorthand term that parties normally use in that county to refer to any lien not being touched, or to have the bank attorneys prepare it. It's quite common.
In that regard, there seems to be quite a bit of reliance matter of fact, the case, as I see it, is pretty much pivoted on just doing the paperwork. What is in the record? What evidence is in the record that the Roosters had any more knowledge about what an M&M lien was than Mr. Trebig did, who represented the bank?
Your Honor, there were five witnesses which spoke to the general concept of what the banking standards were in Burleson County, what loans were normally granted, what was done by the parties, who was representing who, things like that. One of the critical issues in the case, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
One of the critical issues in the case was surrounded an attorney by the name of Mr. James Gray. Mr. Gray was the Ruska's attorney, although they controverted this. There were lien documents filed against the homestead property of the Ruska's in December after the money had basically been advanced. Mr. Ruska and Mrs. Ruska admitted that they had these documents prepared by Mr. Gray and that they themselves filed them a record.
Well, now, was that done, though, long after construction had commenced?
Yes, sir. And it was also done after the funds were advanced and the representation was to the jury.
My question was that you are facing, as I understand it, your claim of misrepresentation by the Ruskas on the fact that when they went and see Mr. Trevy and he said, are the papers, has that thing been done? Now, is it not critical that the Ruskas must understand that papers being done would be an M&M, a valid M&M lien, having been executed by them? Now, Mr. Trebig, as I recall from the record, said he didn't know what that was all about. He wasn't a lawyer, and he didn't know what the lawyer did in that respect. And he kept talking about the commitment from Bradley's Bank. Now, there's not any question, is it, but that the commitment from Bradley's Bank was in existence before the loan by Deanville Bank had been made.
Yes, sir.
So that commitment was there.
Yes, sir.
And that seemed to be the only instrument that Mr. Trebig ever referred to. Okay, we're talking about the commitment. And my problem, I guess, is getting over this misrepresentation hump that don't you have to show that the Ruskas knew themselves, not what the community in general or the banking community in general, and is this Caldwell County, is that
Burleson County,
what the small rural banks in Burleson County did, but that the Ruskas were aware that that was what Mr. Traybig was relying on. And with that knowledge, they represented to him that that M&M lien had been prepared. And I'm just, I want to know what the evidence is that that took place.
Your Honor, of course, there was no direct evidence by the Ruskas admitting they knew and understood what was going on.
Well, what circumstantial evidence would impart that knowledge of the requirements of an M&M lien to the Ruskas?
Well, there was hotly contested evidence regarding who Mr. Gray represented and whether or not he was representing Mr. and Ms. Ruska prior to the advancement of funds. And Mr. Gray is the attorney.
Well, is there any evidence that they contacted Mr. Gray in regard to this transaction before Brazos Bank informed Bank of Deanville that there was no M&M lien and they called the Roosters to come in and let's get this straightened out? Is there any evidence that Mr. Gray was aware of this problem at all until that occurred and the Roosters went to him?
Yes, sir. Mr. Gray had represented the Roosters in the sale of their home in Deanville, which had occurred several months prior to all these transactions. Then the position the Ruskas took during the trial was he sold that house. We didn't talk to him again until December, and then we went and talked to him again. The bank's position, based on Mr. Trivick's testimony, that they had represented to Mr. Trivick, to the bank, that Mr. Gray was their attorney, and that when they had affirmatively undertaken the obligation to prepare the M&M documentation, they had indicated they were going back to Mr. Gray. He was their attorney. He had just represented them in the sale of the house. Now, there was no direct evidence from the Ruskas admitting that they knew and understood what M&M liens were because, of course, that would have been very damaging to their case. But there was testimony from Mr. Trivick indicating that he understood that Mr. Gray was their attorney, and he understood that the loan documentation, the M&M liens, or the paperwork, as they actually refer to it, had been done prior to the advancement of funds. Obviously, in a situation like this, had the Ruskas come in and said, we want to borrow $85,000 on an unsecured basis, the bank wouldn't have done it. There had to be some kind of misrepresentation there in order to induce the bank to give out this amount of money on any basis.
And I can't imagine. It could be just plain carelessness. It's your administrative part, isn't it?
Well, and that was probably the position that the Ruskas would have liked the jury to believe. But again, the strict jury findings, issues 12 through 16, the jury found that there was a misrepresentation, that it was false, that it was material, that it was made with an intent that the bank rely on it, and the bank did rely on it.
Were any of those issues or findings challenged for either legal sufficiency or factual insufficiency in the Court of Appeals?
Yes, sir, and I believe that's also the point of the error, points of error number 3 and 4 in this court is sufficiency of the evidence. Just to briefly summarize, there were 5 witnesses in the case which testified to issues germane to those, to facts germane to those jury issues. It was Mr. Friday, who was the loan officer that actually spoke face-to-face with the Roosters. Mr. Keegan, who was a bank officer. Mr. Nelson, who was a bank officer. Mr. Dixon DeGraffenreid, who was an attorney in Burleson County, and testified as to the normal and the fact that this transaction was not unusual in terms of current practice or normal practice in Burleson County. And there was an interesting point because the Ruskas brought forth a bank officer by the name of Rudy Unick from a local bank who testified in their behalf regarding general banking practices. And on cross-examination, he even admitted that he had had situations when he relied on attorneys, a borrower's attorney, to prepare the loan documentation, and he had granted loans and issued funds on representations that had been accomplished without ever having it reviewed. So if there were at least 5 witnesses in the case who confirmed that the course of conduct between the parties was not unusual in terms of Burleson County, Texas, and that the bank was not per se negligent by relying on Roosters. And throughout this entire appellate process, the Ruskas have sort of suggested in a veiled manner that the bank was in some way negligent by believing them. And there is some case law cited in my brief. I cited the court wants to hear it, but it is in the brief, which basically says that the rule is not that you can escape the consequences of your fraud by claiming the other party to be negligent. The very purpose of fraud is to get someone to negligent the precautions necessary to protect their own interests. So if you are successful in misleading someone, you can't later come back and say, I wasn't worthy of belief. you were negligent, therefore I am forgiven for my misrepresentation. That's not the law of the state of Texas. I don't think it should be. Now, if I might discuss with the court briefly the case of Lincoln versus Bennett, which I believe the Roosters have relied on to a great extent. In that case, there is a community manual list that lawyers are always fond of quoting regarding three situations in which the court had enforced certain liens against a homestead. But that list of three cases is liens which are created neither for purchase money nor for improvement. Now, Lincoln versus Bennett does not apply in this case for this reason, and I quote from the case. It is undisputed that the loan held by and the named parties was not made for purchase money or any part thereof, or for taxes due on such property, or for work and material used in constructing improvements thereon. The Lincoln versus Bennett case is applying to situations outside of the Constitution. There are three clearly delineated reasons or purposes for which liens can be imposed against the homestead. In the Lincoln versus Bennett case, we were outside of those constitutional big three, if I can refer to them that way. But in this case, we are within the Constitution. This is a lien for improvements on the homestead, for building this party's home. All they had to do was borrow the money and pay for it, just as many, many other citizens in our state do. They had taken a position contrary to what they took when they borrowed the money. They represented to the bank that they had done the paperwork, that liens were in place, that money could be loaned, that the home could be built. The bank, in reliance on those representations, loaned that money in a series of notes. The Roosters have built themselves a beautiful home in rural Burleson County, Texas. All the bank wants is to be paid. We are not trying to take the Roosters' home away from them, although if they won't pay, we are asking the court to stop them from asserting the invalidity of the lien against the homestead and to uphold the judgment lien which was granted by the trial court because of the failure and refusal and the continued failure and refusal for the Roosters to simply pay back the money they had admittedly borrowed.
Mr. Chapman, in response to or in regard to the question Judge Gonzalez asked earlier about the making payments, now, before the first payment would ever have been due, this problem arose, did it not?
Yes, sir.
Was there ever a payment schedule, like you're going to say, an amortization schedule given to the Roosters to say your monthly payments are so-and-so? Was that step ever taken after this problem arose?
Yes, sir.
And when were the Roosters given that?
Prior to the institution of suit and during the suit on more than one day.
You say prior to the institution of the suit, but after the problem arose as to what the situation was.
I don't wish to go outside the record.
It's not the record then. I'm sorry.
I don't want to mislead the court. We handled the case from inception all the way through trial and everything else. But I don't want to overstep my bounds.
But there's nothing in the record then of all this that I've asked you about.
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Another thing that I'd like to point out to the court is that there is case law in the state of Texas to the effect that the homestead can be waived. The Roosters don't have to assert that. They could, if they wish, go ahead and pay for their home, notwithstanding the problems in creating the lien. And in the case of Vincent versus Magnum, which is a 1938 case, writ refused. Trial court quoted a case called Schoenker versus Citizens Loan and Investment by noting that the homestead exemption does not arise as a matter of right so as to preclude any action against the property so impressed. It's an exemption or right that may be waived at the option of the party entitled to the exemption or right. In summation, I'd just like to say that Dingle Bank performed fully its part of the contract. They advanced the money. The Roosters obtained all the benefits of the contract. They have built their home. All the bank is asking for is to be paid back. The Roosters have failed and refused to make any payments. They continue to fail and refuse to make any payments. The exceptions listed in Lincoln versus Bennett are inapplicable to this case. I believe that the trial court rendered a correct judgment. I believe that the Court of Appeals correctly analyzed the situation. and upheld the trial court's judgment in imposing a judgment lien and also ordering an estoppel to prevent Mr. and Ms. Ruska from taking a position now that is contrary to the position they took when they induced the contract. I would ask the Supreme Court to uphold the Court of Appeals' opinion and to allow equity to prevail in this case. Now, one thing I would hope the court would submit to the court is that we're not asking that the homestead law be continued or that the law in this state be changed. And the law that we're asking the court to apply to this case is law that has existed from back in the 30s. The two cases that I cited to you about the wrongful conduct of the party as stopping someone from asserting the invalidity of a lien. That's simply the law that I asked the court to apply. It's been a law in this state for many, many years. I don't think that anything in this case is an exception or any new inroads be made against the homestead laws, which are certainly worthy of diligent protection by this court. We're simply asking that the laws of estoppel be applied and that the bank be allowed to maintain a lien on the property so that they may obtain repayment. Without that lien, repayment is illusory.
Is it the Ackerson case and the Rabb case?
Yes, sir.
On page 6 of your court appeal brief that you're relying on?
Yes, sir.
Are there other cases you're relying on for that, you say, well-settled proposition?
I'm embarrassed to admit that I'm trying to get a bunch of cases.
From claiming the homestead. The Rabb case,
And the other case that's cited in the brief of the respondent, all fit within those three categories. And there has been no overruling of that case, no question of it that I know of, since it was decided a number of years ago, almost 50 years ago.
Let me ask you on that, if I understood Banks counsel, it said that the Rabb case and the Axton case held that recovery is permitted, that is, I assume, a lien, enforcement of a lien, but you can clear that up for me. He just said the recovery is permitted. I'm going to assume from my question that means a lien can be imposed. You correct me if
that's
that
exactly
right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Said not because the lien is valid, but because they are stopped to assert it is not valid. Because if you don't apply estoppel, it would inequitably defraud and damage another. That was the gist of what I heard being said about the Rabb case.
And that language is used in that case, but Your Honor, that case is within the three exceptions that are stated in Lincoln v. Banks.
All right, distinguish it for me, because I don't want it to. I'm trying to resolve the legal conflict between you all here. How would you, if you were writing this, write around the Rabb analysis that I just gave you?
The Rabb case was one in which there was a sale of the property and the parties remained in possession, or there had been a deed, and that the looking at the best evidence that you could get, that is the record of the deed, they stopped themselves in that manner in that case, if I recall.
Now, your position, counsel, as I understand it, is that your clients made no misrepresentations, therefore there was no fraud. Since there was no fraud, there couldn't be a stop.
That is exactly right, Your Honor. That is my position in the case. But my secondary position in the case is that even if you give credence to the jury's finding that there was a misrepresentation made, still, the circumstances under which it was made are circumstances under which you cannot ignore the Constitution's prohibition, because they did not do it in one of the three situations in which they can stop themselves. And I probably made a mistake by creating so much emphasis on that, because if you look at the record, you'll find that Mr. Frazee testified that they indicated that the paperwork had been done. If you'll distinguish between the questions that were asked and the answers that were given by Mr. Frazee, there never was any statement by Mr. Frazee that they actually even told him that the paperwork had been done. The only thing he testified was they indicated it. I asked them if everything was ready to go, and they said yes. And that is the evidence upon which it is claimed that they misrepresented something to the bank.
I understand you weren't trial counsel, but that's correct, is it? You didn't try.
I did not try.
Was there a reported jury argument?
No.
Is it reported? No, I'm just wondering whether any of this, in other words, did trial counsel make issue with the jury on whether there was or wasn't misrepresentation on the court charge?
I have no knowledge of that, Your Honor. I don't know.
Anything further?
Yes,
we're going to take a short break. Thank all counsel.
The audience will please rise.